community of Isla Vista, spelled Isla Vista, is unique in many, many ways. And yet another distinction is the extensive documentation of local history that has been created attempting to capture its uncommon spirit. A great number of local histories have been created concerning the campus unrest of the winter and spring of 1970. Check out www.kcsb.org in the alumni section for the full interview with Cy Gottfried. And for other local histories, they can be found at islavistahistory.com and legendarysurfers.com, as well as islavista.org. Thanks for tuning into Sprouts this week. I've been your announcer, Fabienne Boudreau, from the campus of the University of California, Santa Barbara, KCSB 91.9 FM.
We here at KCSB would like to dedicate this production of Sprouts to Tom Borghi, known to many in our community as Gene Poole, a longtime volunteer here. We lost him to cancer recently. Thanks go out to Tim Owens, Cy Gottfried, and Malcolm Galt-Williams for providing audio from our archives, and to the Special Collections staff at UCSB's Davidson Library for their help in restoring some of the audio. Thanks also go to Pacifica Radio for distribution.
Once again, the spring meetings of the IMF and World Bank are fast approaching. This year, the meetings of the IMF and World Bank will be April 16th. That's right, the anniversary of the Battle of the World Bank fought in Washington, April 16th, 2000. In the past 4 years, the tide of battle has begun to turn in our direction. At a recent meeting of the G7, that is the seven richest countries on earth, they finally agreed that 100% debt relief for impoverished countries is possible. They've been kicking us around since last year under the pressure that advocates of poorer nations have been applying. Now is the time. This is the place to lay on that finishing blow against odious debt. For those of you listeners who don't understand what the IMF and World Bank are doing, odious debt means debt that cannot be paid. It is similar to predatory lending in the inner city, or a bank that wants to acquire real estate in a poor neighborhood starts by offering people credit cards till they get in trouble, then offering to convert the credit cards to home mortgages, knowing the mortgages could never be paid, or just offering people mortgages for homes, knowing the mortgages could never be paid. And then the banks end up seizing the houses so they can assemble a whole block and sell it to a real estate developer. Well, the IMF and the World Bank were about seizing the resources of entire nations so they can be turned over to large corporations. Countries have debts and dictators ran up in the 70s. The IMF and the World Bank, instead of saying, you shouldn't have to pay the debts that a previous government was overthrown, ran up. Instead, they try to sell these countries on schemes giving up control of all their oil, all their gas, all their minerals, and all their forests. In return, fake debt relief. They're asked to eliminate union rights, pensions, sometimes a quadruple the prices of food and water. There were riots in Bolivia over that to force Bolivia to tell the IMF to take a hike. The IMF is simply the world's largest predatory lender, along with its comrades in arms at the World Bank. So every spring in Washington, like the ancient Asian tradition, legend that there is a battle fought periodically between the forces of good and the forces of evil. Well, so right here in D.C., every spring and every fall, we stand against international predatory lending. It's not enough to stand against international predatory lending. There's enough of a problem with that right here in D.C., but it's a start. If we can establish as an international principle that loans which are offered without regard for the ability to pay with the intention of acquiring underlying collateral, that is, whether you own a house or whether you're a whole country, if a bank offers you loans with the primary intention of acquiring that house or acquiring that country's natural resources, that such debt is odious and should not be paid, if we can establish that principle, then that will come down real hard on predatory lending, both internationally and right here in occupied Washington, saving people's homes. This is WSQT, The Squat, guerrilla radio, broadcasting from the heart of occupied Washington, asking everyone who can to come to the April 16th protests of the IMF and World Bank.
And come to the protest and also listen to the upcoming Bathurst Piers Broadside Show. That's next on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 101.1 FM. Stay with us today. Today is February 24th. That's February 24th, 2005. And looks like tape problems. Dear. Well, instead of the usual intro, we're going to pull a different intro. So stay ready and we'll do some introing.
Strangers on the right, with lots of money, seems they're mostly white, except of course their money. They control the news, TV and radio. If you have a home, they hold the mortgage, they sell you your car, they sell insurance. If you have a job, you probably work for them. Even though they're in high income brackets, they have such loopholes. They pay no taxes, just like Ross Perot. They have so much dough. With their personal corporate profits, they can run for public office. They exploit the world, they have no conscience. If you wind up poor, it's not their problem. They don't give a damn, those strangers on the right.
lot of money, seems they're mostly white. Except, of course, their money, they control the news, TV and radio. If you have a home, they hold the mortgage, they sell you your car, they sell insurance. If you have a job, you probably work for them. Even though they're in high income brackets, they have such loopholes. They pay no taxes, just like Ross Perot. They have so much dough. With their personal corporate profits, they can run for public office. They exploit the world. They have no conscience. If you wind up poor, it's not their problem. They don't give a damn. Those strangers on the right. Strangers on the right.
And that's Strangers on the Right from Jazzy Political Music by David Winters. I'm Robert Norris. Some of us are a stranger on the left, but you'll have to be the judge of that. You're tuned again, as mentioned before, to Free Radio. That's freakradio.org or 101.1 FM. And if you want to call into this show where we talk about civil rights locally and elsewhere, you can try, and you'll probably get through, 427-3772, area code 831, 831-427-3772. And the chat room seems to be working. It's easy to reach, pagesincolor.com, www.pagesincolor.com, in case you can't get through on the phone. You want to be a part of the discussion. I'm having problems with the tapes, the cassette decks, but I'm hoping that it's because things have been switched around a little and I'm slow on the uptake, which is quite possible because... By cracky, I am slow on the uptake. Let's see if we can actually get a street interview here, and that'll tell us if I'm on top of it or underneath it. We'll see.
It's always good to be defended. So here you are in your blue T-shirt, leaning against your bicycle, Mr. Juggler Man, the man who juggles those questionably solid balls. And some would say you have to have a lot of balls to juggle them. But you also claim to be a unicyclist without a unicycle.
Oh, yes.
What's that about?
Oh, I just don't have a unicycle personally, but you can't ride one down here.
Certainly not. Yeah. At least
certainly not.
Not on the sidewalk, anyway.
Wait. So you can be in the street? But how's that part of a performance?
Well, if you're going to perform, get yourself a theater, man. This is Santa Cruz.
Wait, now, isn't this supposed to be a friendly place for street performers, as it is quoted at the Downtown Information Center?
Hey, listen,
Santa Cruz is a street performer-friendly place.
Well, of course. In fact, they have a hospitality squad to give you tickets if you get out of line.
No, it's more the police, not the hospitality.
The hospitality squad.
The hospitality's all right.
They come up and they finger you, and then the police come.
That's right. And they tell you you're going to get a ticket for that if you continue. Yes.
Have you been hassled, by the way, in any of your performances? It sounds like you haven't.
No, not particularly. I mean, they do ask you not to do it in front of that one place.
Which place is that? Pacific Trading Company?
Yes.
You mean the police are colluding with the Pacific Trading Company to deny you the right to do that?
No, just the Pacific Trading Company all by themselves.
So they came out and they asked you?
Yes.
Not to juggle?
Only once when I was there.
And they were afraid that your balls might be picked up by an angry homeless person and thrown through the window?
For any reason.
And how long ago was this request made?
A long time ago.
And have you, in fact, obeyed their dictate and not gone back?
Yes.
You good boy, you.
Oh, no, not that.
Well... Thank you, Ian. And how can people find you? Do you have a regular juggling schedule, or do you have to juggle?
Del Mar.
From the Del Mar Theater.
Yeah, after movie shows. So.
Particularly on weekends, or?
Yeah, particularly on weekends and Fridays.
Sounds good.
Yes.
All right, because you are, of course, a miraculous juggler.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
All right. A man with a guitar on his back. What have you got here?
Good.
kids. Pretty good. I'm doing interviews for Free Radio Santa Cruz. What instrument is that you have there?
That's my banjo.
Have you been banjoing it up downtown?
Yeah, until the cops harassed me, and that's about it.
Oh, and how long ago did that happen?
Oh, that's happened like 6 times in the last 6 weeks.
And what kind of harassment does this amount to?
Well, most of it just, they just tell me I have to go, I have to move, and if I don't move, they're going to give me a ticket.
Now, are these the light blue cops or the dark blue cops?
What do you mean? They're police officers.
And the light blue cop is the community service officer.
They are cops.
Oh, they're all cops. But I'm just wondering which ones they are. Are they both?
No. It's primarily just the police officers.
So it's the dark blue cop?
Yeah.
And do you recall the last encounter you had with them?
4 days ago.
Can you just... And where were you at that time?
I was over there by the Santa Cruz bookstore.
Bookshop Santa Cruz. And... What did they tell you? What happened?
You said that there was a complaint. Somebody said that I couldn't play there and I had to move.
They didn't like your banjo playing?
Well, I don't see why they would have any problem with it. I've played with a number of professional bands. And
perhaps your lyrics were off color?
No. I try to keep my off color lyrics pointed in the right direction.
Well, had you spent the mandatory $120 per day downtown?
Oh, I don't have to spend $120 a day mandatory downtown. That would be a violation of my civil rights if I had to.
We
do
would
that.
Never violate your civil rights in Santa Cruz. I hope you realize that.
Do I realize violation of civil rights in Santa Cruz? Well, I'm one of the key noters of violations of my civil rights in Santa Cruz.
Do you feel secure enough to give your name to the Free Radio audience?
Sure, Scott Hart.
And Scott, have you ever been ticketed or have you just been harassed?
I have been harassed 16 times in 9 years and been ticketed twice.
And has that 16 times been in Santa Cruz or in Santa Cruz, another city?
No, in Santa Cruz, on Pacific Garden Mall.
Now, you know that they do occasionally harass people. Would you say it's occasional or systematic for everybody, or do you think that you yourself have been targeted, or have you been unlucky?
Systematic. You know, they spend certain days. You got to be in touch with their time schedules. That's the only way you get around the good cop, bad donut, no thing.
And have you mastered that art?
I believe so. In the number of years I've been playing here, I haven't actually got a ticket in my hand for a number of years, but I have been harassed. So I deem myself
an expert.
I won't say
a seasoned professional.
Seasoned. There we go. That's a great word for it.
Now, this warning you got from, do you remember the name of the officer who gave it to you?
Oh, yeah, Pam. Oh, yeah. I think
Officer Bechtel, so she was actually in light blue. She wears light blue.
Wait, yeah, she was wearing light blue that day, but I've seen her wear dark blue also.
Really interesting, because they've upgraded her. But what do you remember any of the dialogue you had, other than, I guess you already told me, pretty much.
Most of the dialogue I have already told you.
Where were you? Were you sitting on the...
Standing. Oh, no. I know the law. I really know about the foot procedure,
and
how many feet away from an opening, how many other...
And plus, near the bookshop, Santa Cruz is one of the two exempt zones in Santa Cruz. There are two exempt zones.
That's what they call exempt. But the exempt all has to do with a selective kind of thing that they choose about. It has nothing to do with it being a free zone to play. It has more to do with being selective. They deem that the fact that if you stand there, that you are subjecting yourself to any type of personal search and seizure, any type of harassment that they deem worthy of laying a forth upon you.
Have the police, including Officer Pam Bechtel, the fastest ticket book in the West, ever actually searched you?
Not her, per se, but there have been three others there that were in town, but they were blue shirt.
What was their pretext?
Their pretext was that they wanted to, because I was playing music there, and they felt as though that because of it was their time and duty that they should shake my pockets at the same time.
And were they doing this, incident to a ticket?
Another one at my office. All right.
Never. Never was the incident I didn't receive the ticket first before my pockets were shut.
Did you suggest that you did objected to the search and didn't want to be searched?
Oh, I had no reason to object to it. I've been cross medical marijuana for a number of years, and when they shook my pockets and found my pot, I couldn't say anything, but I told you so.
Right, but you certainly have the right to say, I don't want to be searched unless you have probable cause to search me because you believe a crime is...
They deemed that it was probable cause because of the fact that they were about ready to write me a ticket. Thus, in fact, they thought that it would be mandatory if they were going to either arrest me or give me a ticket.
And the ticket was for?
The first ticket I ever received in Santa Cruz was, they called it aggressive panhandling.
How long, this was back in the 90s?
Yes, yes, this was 91.
And we are going to leave that there for the moment, an interview with Scotty, the banjo guy downtown, because on the line with us, we have none other than Ralph Myberg of the Coalition for Progressive Tomorrow. You give me the right name, Ralph. What is it?
Scrap.
Scrap.
Santa Cruzans for Rational and Responsible Planning. Santa Cruzans for Responsible Planning.
Scrap. So you're feeling kind of scrappy today, is that the deal?
Yeah, I'm feeling real scrappy because we have lots of petition gatherers on the streets. They have signs. We're the wolves. We're taking back the territory. And the signs have a great wolf head on it, and they're saying, who's afraid of the big bad vote? And we have a terrific response from the community. We have lots of volunteers out there gathering.
And you're talking, of course, about can you hear me, Ralph?
Yeah.
You're talking about the Santa Cruz Hotel and the referendum to reverse a 4-3 city council decision to proceed with at least $1.5 million worth of proceeding, or a million or so, toward the development of this hotel, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm sorry, Robert. I thought the subject was opened up, but that is the case. And what we're trying to do is put this up to the vote of the people. Obviously, there's a bare majority on the council. It's a huge issue. Many people in the community, most people, were unaware of the magnitude of this project, of the financial responsibility that we will incur. Simply the inappropriateness of the site and the scale of this project, and also we feel it's a violation of the Coastal Act and basically attempts to attack the provisions that we have agreed on and submitted as part of our local coastal plan. We feel that the city council majority acted probably on the basis of their own thinking, but it didn't reflect the community value or the community thought. Certainly, they were lobbied by self-interest groups that have some legitimate basis for their concerns, and we have alternatives that we hope will meet their pressing concerns. We're beginning to develop that, especially requesting a two-basis increase in the TOT, the transient occupancy tax, and my understanding is that that item is going to be agendized in the very near future at the city council.
Let me interrupt you for a minute, Ralph.
Sorry.
You're doing fine. I just wanted to ask you, I'll occasionally break in as is my prerogative here.
Mm-hmm.
You were at the last city council meeting on Tuesday, a couple days ago, and you spoke at oral communications at 7 o'clock at the council meeting. And you and others did propose this transient occupancy tax, which is a tax on people who come to town and stay in hotels as a way of raising money. What kind of a reaction did you get from Mayor Rotkin and the city council when you and others brought it up?
The point we made was that we only need a bare majority, a 50% plus one vote of the people to implement this raise in the transient occupancy tax, which is something other communities are doing, or they have higher rates anyway, and that Mayor Rotkin pointed out that the last two attempts at raising the tax failed, and that was due to the fact that the revenues were specifically allocated either to the social services in one instance or to the CVC hotel industry in the second instance. And when you allocate specifically, you need a two-thirds majority vote. Both measures failed the two-thirds, but they each received over 50% of the vote. We're advocating that we simply ask that the money be directed to the general fund, and that only requires a simple majority, which we feel is more than achievable. People are very aware of the financial needs of the city, and this is a very easy way to do it. It's correctly placed in terms of who should be paying for resources and for infrastructure costs, sharing them with us.
Ralph, why wasn't this tried last time? I mean, it could have, if it would have passed, if it had more than 50%, which it did, but instead they used the specific approach, which required 66%. Why didn't these two prior attempts use your general funding instead of the specific allocation approach?
It was sort of self-interest politics, unfortunately. Each group in their own turn felt that they could win the two-thirds majority and gather all the revenues for their own specific causes.
It was an
unfortunate contest.
It wasn't a matter of people distrusting the city council and thinking they didn't want to just dump a lot of money in the general fund of the city council and tell them, here, spend it any way you want, but rather they wanted to say, here, it has to go into this particular purpose or in this and that particular purpose?
Yeah, there is that element of concern. And I would say that it's small-minded and doomed to failure, you know, which obviously it was.
You're not saying trust your local city council, are you?
I'm sorry?
Are you telling us to trust our local city council with more money?
Well, you know what? Putting more money into the general fund, whether it comes from irrational, overwhelming development, or whether it comes from sensible raising of revenue, amounts to the same thing. I think there's a basic responsibility and understanding now in the community about where and how funds should be directed. And without specifying it in an actual vote, then, you know, it's achievable. So I don't know. I can't account for the divisiveness in the past. I certainly, at the council meeting many years ago when they were asking the city council to put this up for the vote, the hotel industry initiative, I advocated that they broker a deal with the social services so that we don't have a mounted opposition, because with a mounted opposition, it's very difficult to get a two-thirds vote. So I'm very confident we'll get a majority vote.
You
want
to both the
socials. It's a great way of raising almost twice the money.
You wanted both the social services and the CVC, the business side, to get together, and they didn't. But what's to stop, you know, let's suppose this passes. What's to stop the 4-3 city council majority from dumping all this money into more development projects?
Well, it'll go into the general fund. So, and, you know, I think there's a goodwill on the council to dedicate it to social services, as well as they've already dedicated a great deal of money to the CVC. The you know, tourist industry, they're receiving, I think, $250,000 a year already out of the fund, and I think if they want to continue to be funded in these difficult times, that they will be on board. And I think social services certainly understand the city dilemma, and I think they'll be on board because
well, I mean, I agree with you that both these groups may be on board, but once this passes by 50%, and once the city council gets the money, what's to stop Madrigal, Coonerty, Matthews, and Rotkin from running away with the money and handing it over to business and developmental interests?
You know, technically, is there any inhibition there? No. But will they do it in reality? No. They understand the overall fairness of revenue allocation in these very difficult times. So I think we passed that stage of immaturity and contest, and that we all understand the general welfare of the city. Robert, that's the best I can do on that subject.
I mean, do you think that their maturity in allowing an extensive and fair debate on the Santa Cruz Hotel leads us to believe that they're going to be any fairer on other issues? I mean, I'm trying to give
you a critical
perspective.
I hear what
here.
You're saying. Yeah. I hear what you're saying. And I think, you know, that even though there appears to be an inherent contradiction over here in my position, I think that part of the behavior of city council people at this point is they were caught in a momentum to have this hotel conference center approved, and that the momentum was established in the last city council. And I honestly believe that it was unfair to the incoming city council people to put them into this position at such an early state, although they would probably disagree with me. I, as a political analyst and observer of local politics, really feel it was an unfair imposition, that they should have been allowed to find their way, understand the rules, develop a certain maturity in the process, and gather their own positions.
Ralph, how did Mayor Rotkin respond to this TOT tax, and how did Councilmember Fitzmaurice respond?
Well, Mayor Rotkin pointed out that that sometimes it's easier to pass a two-thirds majority and allocate the money simply because of the factor you brought up, is that people might not trust what government will do with the revenues ultimately, and that sometimes it's easier to get a two-thirds majority than 50% majority. I personally find that humorous, in that both results were over 50%, even with opposition. So I can't say too much about that. I think Councilperson Fitzmaurice questioned Mayor Rotkin's sort of response, saying that why don't we just listen and regard these things more seriously and give it a lot more credibility rather than try offhand to show the weaknesses. Let's try and gather on the strengths. And I think that was very firmly echoed by Ed Porter, Councilman Porter.
And what did our Vice Mayor Cynthia Matthews have to say?
What did she say?
Yes.
She didn't say anything.
Ah,
it wasn't really an open debate, and I think the way Councilperson Fitzmaurice addressed it was that he wasn't really eager to have a conversation at that point, but he felt compelled to speak out.
Because Mayor Rotkin was derogating and disparaging the speakers? Or?
Not embracing the idea, but beginning to negate it or obfuscate it somehow. Robert, I would like to go back to our petition thing, can we?
Please, go ahead.
Because I have to leave in a few minutes.
Go ahead.
But I would like to say this much, is that we have petition gatherers out there. We have a building. We have a real momentum. I'm encouraging all city voters to sign the petition. The opposition led by John Lane, the paid consultant for the hotel industry, is trying to send out what they call blockers to encourage people not to sign the petition. And yesterday at the farmers market, it was sort of almost encouraging. They had this young man from Pescadero who was paid to hand out these green forms saying don't sign the petition. So we thought that was rather shallow and also indicative of a real negativity in this. And that's why our basis is this is a huge issue for the community. Let's vote on it. And that seems to be participatory democracy at its best. And people who are afraid of the vote really should examine their motives. It sort of enhances the concept that this is a move by special interests who don't really want the community to weigh in it in a full way. So,
Lane, by the way, I ran into him at the same farmer's market yesterday. He said he was no longer a paid consultant, and he was indeed giving out the green flyer that you point out that urges people not to sign the referendum. Although I think he was outnumbered by the folks at different points with clipboards in the farmer's market urging the referendum be passed and signed.
Mm-hmm. Well, that could be so. A long time ago, I had asked him whether he was a paid consultant, and he told me no, and later on acknowledged that he wasn't, but he had been. So, I don't know the full semantics or will be in the future. I have no idea on that.
How can
right
people
now.
Sign the petition if they want to? How can they get in touch? You got a phone number for them?
People who would like to gather the petition or find out where petition people are actually, standing. The phone number would be 420-1133, and that's Bill Malone's.
420-1133, and any estimates as to how far you are along? I know the rain has kind of cut into your time there, right?
We're doing really well. I believe we're halfway there, as I say, there's a gathering momentum. People are calling up eager to circulate the petitions. People are calling up wanting to sign them. So we feel that our effort is really picking up steam, and the more people learn about the project, about the magnitude of the imposition, that the more they're coming on board.
Well, according
to, we've done good fundraising as well. Uh-huh. So, you know, it's good.
According to Sarah Phelan in yesterday's Metro, as you may know, 10 mayors now oppose your effort compared to, let's say, 6 who support it. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, it's sort of funny again that there we have active people, the ones that are against this are actually active in negating it. Whoever brought the old mayors from the past on board to make a statement certainly called them. They feel this is some type of charade game that's going on. We don't look at it as that. We have active support of people that are severely distressed by the magnitude and the imposition of this project and the public financing involved. We have real questions out there. I find something sort of funny is that I help campaign for Mike Rotkin against most of the people that he mentioned were in support of this project.
And who are those ex-mayors?
Larry Edler, Woods, Gio, I don't know. You know, people that I actually, some of them I have friendships or like, but certainly on a political spectrum have opposed and would oppose me. A real good question would be how many of those mayors that Mike is referring to have run against him and who he prevailed against. So, you know, it's a very interesting sort of dilemma for him.
But wasn't there general
it's not a numbers game.
Wasn't there
it's
an
a
agreement?
Qualitative situation.
I mean, didn't Mike essentially lose progressive support, lost scan support way back in the mid-90s when he kind of sort of jumped on the developer bandwagon way back then?
Well, he's sort of moving over. He's been moving over more and more, and it's baffling to his earlier supporters. So I can't comment too much more on that except to say that I think he's wrong in this situation. And it's sort of curious, many of the arguments that he correctly uses against the universities decision-making is exactly the arguments we're using against the city council,
for instance,
decision-making. So, you know, it's a curious dilemma,
for instance,
and I think there's lots of contradictions,
Ralph,
there.
Like what argument are you talking about?
I'm sorry?
What argument are you talking about?
Oh, traffic and not following a process, not listening to the community, all those good sound bites. So, all that, and they're very significant. They have significant meaning. Robert, I have to go.
Hey, Ralph,
I'm late for an appointment. I, as usual, have enjoyed talking on Free Radio.
Hey, thank you,
Ralph. Thank you for the public service you allow for.
Hey, come back again.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye. And that was Ralph Myberg of, I guess it's Santa Cruzans for Responsible Progress Scrap. And, again, you can reach them at 420-1133. If anyone's listening from the other side, I think it's the Community Coalition for Crappy Development. No, that's not what it is. It's got a different name. You can hear my bias, I have to admit. Please give a call in, and we'd be happy to give out your number as well if you wish to mobilize people to stop a referendum and let people know where they can go to subvert the democratic process. In fact, of course, the use of a referendum is to some extent... Although, you know, there's arguments that it's being used here because this is such a massive and expensive project, but there are those who oppose referendums and other issues and supported them on this issue mainly because they support the issue, not so much because they support the process of referendum. People don't get into a referendum process unless they are really concerned about an issue and they think it's really important, and unless they think they're going to lose at the local city council level. Though Ralph has said that he's taking this issue, or they supporters are taking, opponents of the Coast Hotel are taking this issue to the Coastal Commission and expect to prevail there, but they obviously don't necessarily expect to prevail there, or they wouldn't be spending their time trying to get this referendum together, it would seem to me. So it's a political maneuver as well as being one of principle, I'm sure, for some people, too. Do you have any thoughts on this issue? Although, again, it's not normally the kind of thing I cover at great length. I've been covering it a lot of length recently, though. Or on what you've been hearing before, essentially police harassment on the streets downtown on Pacific Avenue, harassment of street performers. You can give a call to 427-3772, 427-FRSC, call in, and I will be here, and you will be able to to be heard. And while you're doing that, why don't I just finish this interview with Scotty, the banjo guy, and then we will proceed to a bit of music.
Have you been searched more recently?
Oh, no. No, it's been a long time. I think it was more the fact that they were wanting to... At that time, they were searching and shaking about every musician that there was on the mall.
So would you say that the musician situation has improved? Because when I came up to you...
Improved?
Yes. As far as police harassment.
Oh, well, as far as police harassment, like I said, it's selective. Some days you can see that they're coming right for you. They give you this eye, this temperament, and generally whenever they're coming, they kind of give you this perception about a quarter block away. They're about ready to harass you.
And how would you compare it with 91? Is it different?
Oh, way different.
How so?
91, there was a different kind of street patrol that was on here. And they didn't really have the right to harass you. So they couldn't harass you at that time. And then the blue cops, the only reason why they harassed you is if you were standing too close to a business.
Well, I want to remind all musicians that SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and...
Freedom and Expression, also known as Street Performers Against Foolish Enforcement, does have a shindig every Wednesday night. And that's Wednesday from 6 to 10. Sometimes goes later, sometimes... stops earlier in front of New Leaf Market. So check that out if you're interested. And then we're going to be playing some clips, cuts, and bits from different SAFE events in the course of this show and the show I do on Sunday, which is played from 9:30 to 1. That's the talk. Now a little music. That's from Inner City, one of my favorite musicals from the 70s based on the Inner City Mother Goose and re-released in the 80s as Street Dreams. Pretty punchy stuff. It was actually censored in a number of places, or at least the book from which it came, the Inner City Mother Goose, it was called. I brought into the studio yesterday's Monterey County Herald. I can't find today's. Apparently it hasn't reached the stands yet, or it hadn't around noon when I was walking around, which is unusual. And I have online here, which I'm looking at, the Monterey Peninsula Herald from the day before yesterday, which is Tuesday. Police taser gun victim dies. Incident adds to controversy over weapons. A Salinas man stunned by five police taser guns died Sunday night in the intensive care unit at Navidad Medical Center, adding another page to the growing controversy over the immobilizing weapons. Robert Clark Heston, 40, a Salinas Valley State Prison parolee who had been struggling to leave drugs and crime behind, was pronounced dead around 7:30 p.m. Sunday night. He'd been admitted into the Salinas Hospital Saturday afternoon after police used taser guns to subdue him while he allegedly was attacking his father and a group of officers at his father's North Salinas home. A friend of Heston said the family told him that Heston had armed himself with a metal pendulum from a grandfather clock and threw it at the officers as they approached. A total of 5 tasers were used. Police Chief Daniel Ortega said Monday, Ortega said Heston had previous arrests for violent behavior, and a close friend who asked not to be identified acknowledged Heston had problems with anger and substance abuse. Anyway, you're getting the story. Here's this mentally ill, violent, drug-using character who the officers just had to defend themselves against, and, you know, he died as a consequence, unfortunately. But, you know, I mean, tasers are better than bullets, and therefore it's a regrettable incident. But next story. And you can scroll down this story about how he was in daily contact with his minister, joined a Bible study group. And these are all quotes from The Friend. Heston's family would not comment. A note on their door said, "Please don't disturb our family. If you come to our property, we'll call police and press charges." And I suppose that should... the reason that's significant is because 2 days later, they do comment. And what they say, and it's not in the Monterey Peninsula Herald story of yesterday, which is, interestingly enough, it hits headline, "Taser victim had history of assaults on police." So, you know, the police are okay because this guy had a history of assaults on the police. That must mean their police behavior is fine. I call that the subtext to these kinds of things. The man who, and this is a long story about how he had previously assaulted police, and he's out of control behavior, blah, blah, blah. And the family finally does talk, and I was able to read that in the Chronicle story from today, and it's a somewhat abbreviated story, and I don't have it here. But my recollection of the story, and you can probably get it online. In fact, I'm going to try to find it online. I'm looking for it, actually, even as we speak, is that when the father said that it was an outrageous action by the police, that he wasn't throwing anything at the officers. He was throwing stuff out of the house, that he, the father, was not being menaced either, that it was absolutely unnecessary that they killed him. And I guess my initial reaction was, you know, why didn't we hear about this earlier? Isn't this an example of selective reporting? And apparently it's not that selective reporting because, according to the original story, the family declined to talk and they had to get some sort of second-hand information from friends and so forth. There's been a lot of controversy around taser weapons. I don't think Santa Cruz police use them, but I don't know. I don't know what their policy is. It's possible that that discussion is in the general orders, which has been posted. I believe it's been posted either on the Huff website or on the Santa Cruz Cop Watch website. The Huff website, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the group I work with, is www.huffsantacruz.org, and Cop Watch is www.santacruzcopwatch.org. If you want to check there, tip of the hat to Tom Belote, who shelled out $73 to get the police orders out of the dungeon. Apparently the police department didn't think enough of the situation to put those general orders, which define the procedures of the Santa Cruz Police Department, in the public library where they should be. But now they're going to be online, thanks to Tom, and that's good news. Let me take a quick look again to see if I can possibly find this Salinas death here. Salinas man dies after taser. Still looking. Let's see. One last look, and I'll see if we... And it looks like stun gun raises concerns, but I'm having trouble locating the exact story. But this is a serious question. There have been over 100 deaths across the country from tasers, and I suppose you can say it's better than shooting someone, you know, shoot to kill. And I suppose there were concerns in the past raised about chokeholds and about pepper spray. So the problem with all these kinds of constraining device, constraining holds, some of which are obviously necessary, you know, in some circumstances, is that they tend to give greater, they multiply, they expand themselves, they give greater latitude to police officers. Instead of being restricted to extremely limited circumstances, they become a kind of a catch-all that's used more, that are used more broadly. And I haven't, again, briefed myself as well as I should have on this issue. I'm hoping I can find today's Monterey Peninsula Herald online, because I think that's going to give us some, maybe this will be it. I think we may have, maybe this story here goes into some detail. Police chief defends use of tasers in recent death. Uh-huh, this is interesting. Police chief, backed by more than two dozen Salinas police officers, Chief Daniel Ortega on Wednesday blamed Robert Clark Heston's death on choices he made and not on the fact that he was shot repeatedly with tasers. Heston, 41, died Sunday night after Salinas police officers fired taser shots at him during a struggle outside a Rodeo Avenue home. Ortega said officers were not able to find any drug-related paraphernalia when they scoured Heston's family home in Salinas. So in spite of all the smear job in the papers that day and the next day about his extensive drug history, they haven't yet got any indication, at least, that there's drug paraphernalia there. Police tried to use tasers on him 10 times, but only 5 of those times were successful. Uniformed officers were standing side by side around Ortega as he delivered the news and fielded a dozen questions. Officers in plain clothes stood in back of the room and showed their support for Ortega. Well, that's charming. I don't know. I mean, I suppose, you know, police officers should be allowed to organize like other folks. It's just, it always strikes me as a little ominous when you see individuals, paramilitary individuals in formation in that fashion. But, you know, certainly people have the right to organize and to speak out on these issues. One wonders if police officers opposing tasers would be able to feel okay testifying about that, and I don't know. Ortega said past actions surrounding Heston have led him to believe Heston may have been under the influence of a controlled substance on Saturday. I'm basing this on his behavior and past history. Police officers found themselves in a confrontation which warranted the use of deadly force. Tasers are not supposed to be deadly force. I guess he's saying it's okay anyway to use deadly force here. Despite officers having fired the taser several times, Ortega said the department does not have a policy limiting the number of times someone can be struck. This is 50,000 volts. Two barbs are shot out at a person, and a charge then runs through those barbs when they hit you. And apparently this happened 5 times. 6 officers have been placed on paid administrative leave, which is a routine department procedure, while an investigation is underway. The officers involved are Sergeants Domicini and so forth. Events began unfolding at Heston's home when police were called by relatives around 1:30 p.m. because Heston was allegedly tearing up the residence. 6 officers responded to this call, 6 officers, at the 100 block of Rodeo Avenue because of previous problems at Heston's house. The officers and sergeants talked to Heston's father, Robert, who told them that his son hadn't beat him, and Ortega said Heston hadn't broken any law at that time. Heston was asked to leave the house but refused, officers reported, and they were unable to contact Heston's parole officer. He was paroled most recently on January 23rd. About 45 minutes after the police arrived, they left the house because no crime had been committed. 3 minutes later, Robert Henry Heston called 911 because his son began beating him, Ortega said. Domenici and Fairbanks responded immediately, saw Heston allegedly dragging his father by his arm in the living room. Officers noted debris from the house littered on the front yard, saw Heston throwing things outside, including a wooden pole which hit Domenici in the chest. Domenici fired his taser, but it didn't knock Heston down because wires may have been broken and Heston may have pulled out the probes. Ortega reported Fairbanks and fired his taser. It had a minimal effect. More officers were called to the house when Heston allegedly threw a weight from a broken grandfather clock at Ruiz as he came toward the house. And there's more discussion of how he was shot with tasers, more stuff about his background, previous incidents, Salinas police, a bill, Lino's bill, Assemblyman Lino's bill to propose that police file reports for the state in every case the controversial stun gun is used. This story does not have any information from the father, which apparently was in the Chronicle story, which says, A, the grandfather clock thing was not thrown at anybody, the pole was not thrown at anybody, he wasn't in any danger. So none of that appears in this story. So I don't know what the facts of the matter are. I just find it interesting, these contradictions. And I just, part of this, of course, is my bias, being suspicious of police accounts, per se. because of my experience with such things as the Happy John Dine case locally, where a local man was shot dead by Officer Connor Carey, one of our Santa Cruz police officers, back in 1997 for allegedly wielding a toy gun, according to then District Attorney Art Danner, then Police Chief Steve Belcher, but not according to any of the witnesses, the non-police witnesses, of which there were 10 to 15 in the subsequent reports. So, I mean, it's a difficult situation to evaluate in the end, but you kind of have to make some decisions, and I thought I would sort of mention it, and I did. And having mentioned it, I will move on to a little music and then to some more interviews, or possibly to your phone calls if you'd like to call in. 427-3772 is the number, and you're tuned to Free Radio at 101.1 FM.
Just a shadow of the sun.
Ooh, yeah.
Just a shadow of the sun.
You can't slow down till the day
I'm choking, and it's February 17th, and I'm here under the awning of the Alfrescos. There's a couple signs here, U.S. out of Iraq, honk, war for oil, line through it, honk, honk, and music for peace. You, sir, you seem to be a musician. You have some kind of guitar on your back, numerous items of food, thermoses, containers, a radio, propaganda, God knows what else is strewn about this Alfrescos, which of course luckily closed. What's been happening here? It looks kind of wet outside on the streets, and last I saw you two, or at least I saw you, Valerie, you were playing across the street. What happened? Are you moved about?
Yeah, we got officially
Bechteled. We got Bechteled.
Oh, that's right.
What exactly happened?
Well, it was that, you know, ordinance of away from the building or else. So we didn't argue the issue. We just thought we'd come over. And
there's actually no ordinance that says you can't perform music next to a building.
We weren't performing.
What were you doing?
We weren't performing. We were standing there with all that stuff.
You can stand with your stuff next to a building. There's no law against it.
Is that what she said? What did she actually say?
What did she say? She said, move along, is what she said.
Move. Oh, what is that?
She created a new law. Well, this is very creative of Officer Bechtel. Perhaps on Saturday when we do the Bechtel Watch, we can see some more creative activity.
You know, the problem is we have become just totally scared of her. We're shaking on our knees, this woman. And, you know, she's just a little too small for that. We shouldn't be without
her. But her ticket book is big.
Oh, yeah, well, she thinks it is. But it's not really. It's just a little book.
And I think she does it to assert her authority, really.
You know what's big? It's her lies. Her lies are really big.
We've run across a couple of, certainly, errors on the part of Officer Bechtel in the last few days. One is, of course, this claiming you cannot have your stuff sitting in front of a building. Now, you can't have a display device. If you were displaying a sign, if you were displaying something that was capable of holding tangible objects, that would have been required you be at least 10 feet away from the building. But if you were simply there, and you didn't have a cap out for a tip, and you didn't have a table, then she had no business moving you along.
Wow.
Also, I know that she told Hawk, as I recall, yesterday, that he could not be walking around town with his bicycle with a sign that said recycling on it, which, of course,
she's
is another creative Bechtel interpretation. She also told people who had their stuff been removed from a vehicle by police, it could not sit on the sidewalk for more than an hour, which, of course, is another misinterpretation of the display device ordinance.
Oh, my goodness. She's just having a creative time.
And she told someone that they couldn't cross. She also, within the same week period, she's told people that you cannot cross Pacific Avenue even holding a dog.
Yeah.
So apparently she's just rewriting the downtown ordinances in order to make them better suit the local circumstances. Well,
yeah, just a quick interruption and correction. Bechtel is correct on the dog matter, and I pointed this out at the last show. Dogs are, although it may be it's okay to hold a dog in your arms, that's sort of been an exception to the rule about walking a dog. The exact wording of the ordinance has to be looked at more carefully. But in the past, officers have told me, other officers, you can cross Pacific Avenue with a dog. You simply cannot walk along Pacific Avenue with a dog. But some of the streets are actually included in the ordinance itself in terms of having a dog on some of the side streets. So that is, Bechtel is accurate in terms of the law on that one issue. The other three issues mentioned, however, she is not, in my estimation.
Other cops walk by me tonight over there and not say anything. So it's just her. She seems to have a higher sense of what's, you know, an ordinance and what's, you know,
or a lower sense,
a serious law to enforce.
She seems to be able to use the laws to assert her authority when she chooses, is what I noticed. But, you know, what time did this incident happen? Do you recall?
Well, the other cops came by just before her, like a few minutes, so I don't remember exactly, but I know we went and got our supplies and set up around 6.
So it was between 6 and 7?
Yep.
Okay, well, that's interesting because I'm, as you know, writing a flyer about Officer Bechtel's exploits.
Right, and we need to know what time she's working, so that means she must be working until 6, because
yeah.
She said, I'm coming back before I go off shift to see if you're still here.
Good. Well, next time she comes back, we can not only have her come back, we can also decline to sign the ticket. We can call the sergeant. I will be there. Maybe I'll get to go to jail this weekend. You never can tell. Although I'm big with my boasts, and I'll probably be small with my actual actions. We'll see.
You guys should take the alcove, since they're bothering us there, you know, instead of New Leaf there. And just take that spot on Saturday and see how she comes over and tells you to leave. Make sure you bring lots of things like we have, you know, because she hates that.
You do seem well armed with the little kind of shopping cart devices,
yeah,
and different kinds of clipboards and so forth. Anything else happen? Any other reports from downtown about what's happening on the streets?
What's happening on the streets? There's a lot of really groovy people down here.
Yeah,
they all came down here and had some great peanut butter and jelly sandwiches, and they were all happily signing petitions. And
one girl held the sign out for traffic, and she got 9 honks in under 5 minutes.
U.S. out of Iraq honks.
She held the, yeah, and it was so amazing. She just went out there, and man, the cars were honking like I'd never seen.
Yeah, that was great. And she was enjoying it too. Boy, was she having fun.
We all just laughed.
Yeah. There was a couple of people that like multi honked.
Oh, no,
real
honkies.
Yeah.
All the way around the corner, all the way down. He honked for forever.
Yeah, he really wanted him out of Iraq.
Hale, you've been out here with your Hurricanes red jacket and giving out these flyers.
I'm outraged myself.
You're outraged, and you're outside as well. Are you getting any of the flyers out to the public?
I'm
so far, 3 people have accepted them.
Yes. Gotten a lot of rejections.
A lot of rejections. This can happen.
Doing better tonight than last night.
Well, let me help you out.
Wow. I thought there was more on the tape than that, but there you have it. So, if you're interested in what's going on with Officer Bechtel and in terms of how police are treating folks downtown, we are putting together a specific cop watch to monitor CSO Bechtel particularly, because she seems to be particularly flagrant, or I should say particularly creative in her use of some of the codes. Or her creation of new codes that, who knows, perhaps the city council will jump on board as they did in 2002 after police began enforcing non-existent codes and create the codes so the police can be ex post facto justified in what they do. Hard to tell there, but could happen. The Bechtel watch that we were going to have last Saturday was called out because of weather and illness of one of the main folks, and then they same illness problem is around, and the same weather problem seems to be around. But if you're interested in being a part of the Bechtel Watch, give a call to the Huff line at 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and you can, in fact, become a part of this, keeping an eye on your local police department. Who knows? Maybe you'll find Officer Bechtel needs to be commended on her work rather than criticized. I mean, that's certainly a possibility, too. While I'm talking about police officers, I want to put in a special plug and tip of the hat to Skidmark Bob for, I'm not sure if it's him or someone else, who put this program, Bad Cop No Donut, which airs Thursday at 1 o'clock on Free Radio, which actually I was tempted to play to repeat on my show. I was so impressed with what I heard a week or two ago. It's a sort of a nationwide report on police misconduct that happens every week, and it's actually stirred up some controversy. It's mentioned on Santa Cruz Indie Media. If you want to check Santa Cruz Indie Media, it's one of the lead stories. It is the lead story right now. Free Radio Santa Cruz interview with Ron Ansich of Bad Cop No Donut, and that's Skidmark Bob interviewing him before a media attack. A Toronto Police Chief Julian Fontino says Bad Cop No Donut promotes hatred of the police. And there's a lot of interesting stuff there on the Indie Media website. On that Bad Cop No Donut. Plus, you can listen to the show, or you can either listen to the stream or download the MP3 from that site. I frequently post on Indie Media. Recently, there's been some controversy around the Jerry Henry case. Jerry Henry is the street minister who the Aptos business folks at Pacific Coffee Roasting Company in the Aptos Center and the Aptos Coffee Roasting Company in the Rancho Del Mar Center are going after big time with 10 misdemeanor prosecutions for the crime of, quote, trespass with intent to interfere with a business. And then there's a couple of disturbing the peace claims as well. And I went to one of Jerry Henry's hearings today, 9:30 in the jailhouse courtroom. He's at liberty on $50,000 bail. It's a serious matter if you stand in front of a store with a sign that tells the public, don't trespass here because you're likely to get arrested. Sarcastic sign. Or if you try to go get a cup of coffee in the store and they decide that you are interfering with business by attempting to get a cup of coffee. It's a clean out the riffraff deal specifically focused on Jerry Henry. And he's luckily got some good counsel from San Francisco, some attorneys from out of town who are methodically gathering the documentation to overturn these charges and then hopefully to sue the pants off these businesses. And I've actually invited the owner, I've invited both the owners of these businesses to respond to concerns that they are engaging in a witch hunt, and it's not even a witch hunt, it's a systematic and focused persecution of against one particular individual and his aides. Jerry Henry is a disabled guy who's got some psychological disability, so he has an aide with him usually. And he also is very careful. He tape records most everything that happens to him when he's in these public places under these confrontational situations. And so he has quite a record of what's gone down. So it's kind of hard to lie about it in court once you get there. It should be interesting when this trial hits the court in April. Huff has voted to do educational informational picketing at Aptos and possibly at the Santa Cruz Coffee Roasting Company, because they're owned by the same Colleen Crosby, who, again, as I said, a nice woman, but she hasn't responded to any concerns. One of the other owners has responded to some concerns, not of me, but of other people. She's posted a dialogue on the Internet. If you want to check out the discussion, and it's kind of interesting, you can go to the Indie Media website, which I'm kind of... trying to find it here. Whoops. Let's try again. And search the site for Jerry Henry. And that's two words, Jerry, and then, of course, Henry, spelled as you would expect. And let's see if it comes up here. Taking a quick look here. Yeah, it's Street Minister Busted Again Friday, $50,000 bail in Aptos is the thread. And it's an interesting and lengthy thread, which I encourage people to take a look at. It has some discussion by both sides, people who are severe critics of Jerry Henry and others who are defending him, and some particularly eloquent commentary from Richard Quigley, who signs himself Quig, and you've heard him on this station. Richard Quigley is a libertarian freedom fighter who's fighting the helmet law, who has had concerns about police abuse, who is hounded off of KSCO by then-Sheriff Mark Tracy, and whose lawsuit against Sheriff Tracy many believe to be, or at least some believe, to be instrumental in Tracy's rather early retirement. And that's kind of interesting, and I think shows some punch and some really positive action from the community, because nothing personal against Sheriff Mark Tracy, but his policies on issues ranging from curfews to the young to general cover-ups for bad cops, if you want, has been kind of legendary. And the idea that he can send stormtroopers into KSCO to tell them who can and who can't speak or to try to put pressure on them is really outrageous. You know, you heard earlier, those of you who were listening between 5:30 and 6, about Isla Vista and the students' radio station there being closed down by the police chief in the middle of what amounted to some extent to property destruction and rioting by the police, property destruction by people, students and so forth, as it was described in that particular segment. But you would have thought not in Santa Cruz, and it's true that KSCO wasn't closed down, but they were persuaded, once Quigley filed a lawsuit against Tracy, to remove him from his hour slot as a Thursday noon commentator, where he was talking about a number of subjects, but one of them was police misconduct. So, check out the Indie Media website for Jerry Henry. And if you're interested in being a part of direct actions to educate the public about, and the public that's patronizing these restaurants and sort of proceeding like business as usual. It's like, it's as though a restaurant were discriminating against Jews or Catholics or blacks or Latinos. When they start discriminating against, quote, riffraff, or when they go after one person this way because of his, essentially he was reclaiming the public space in front of the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center's coffee roasting company, and that, which was right next to the new sheriff's substation, as it's described by Richard Quigley and others today at his trial, or I should say at his hearing, right outside his hearing after the hearing was over. They hired First Alarm Security when they decided they wanted to move along young people who had been using the public area in front of the coffee roasting company, where there were planters to sit on and so forth. And they decided Jerry Henry, who had advised young people that they have a right to stay there if they want, had to go. And so they went after him. And they've gone after him repeatedly, persistently, viciously, since 1996 or 97. And the latest round began in 2004 with when they first they invited him back into the coffee roasting company, and then they set out to prosecute him. A peculiar approach, but, you know, merchants tend to feel that, I guess, once they get together and they start rationalizing and reifying and endorsing their own worldview, they don't pay much attention to the rights of the public. Rights of the public don't really enter into some merchants. I don't want to say all merchants. But, you know, you see this in Santa Cruz with the downtown ordinances. And in Aptos, it's... I don't know if I'd say it's worse. Aptos and the Rancho Del Mar Shopping Center, certainly for Jerry Henry, it's worse. So I'll be trying to give updates on this. And, again, trying to compile a flyer. Usually I'm pretty good at this, but I've been kind of waiting for information from Jerry Henry's group. Jerry Henry has a concern about keeping kind of information close to the chest because he has trials coming up. My concern as a member of Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom is to get the information out there so that people who are homeless, who have been harassed by this restaurant or others, come forward and talk about it. And you know, I'd actually like to see a process that allows for mediation and resolution of disputes and concerns, codes of conduct. I've talked about this for years. Instead of using police force and the city council, merchant-initiated rubber-stamped laws that essentially criminalize a lot of behavior that is completely innocent and weight the scales unduly in favor of commercial interests downtown and against those who are more powerless, poorer, and outside. And that's what this show is all about. Anti-war is another issue for me. The war in Iraq, I often talk about it here, and today is going to be no exception. I want to first note that I'm still trying to see if the Anti-War Org, which is a new organization, which I think meets on Fridays up at the Bay Tree Convention Center on the campus. That's tomorrow. They met last Friday, according to the Indy Media. Let's see if they're still around here. And I'm trying to use the computer at the same time as I'm talking to you. If anybody out there has any information on whether there is a meeting of the student organization tomorrow at, I think it was a meeting at 5 o'clock, please let me know. Call in, 427-3772. You probably also know that there's a Peace Saturday that happens now between 12 and 2 on the 41st Avenue overpass, quite successful. There's some nice photos of it on the Santa Cruz Indy Media website. Sam Farr is holding a meeting Saturday from 10 to 11:30 in the Santa Cruz City Council chambers, not on war or anti-war. That might be too much for old Sam, but on Social Security. But you can bring an anti-war sign or two with you, because if they're going to be spending all this money on the war, and was it $7 billion a month, it's going to gut, obviously, all the other services and give a lot more impetus for claims that we have to cut back on Social Security and such things as that. That's a representative, if you like to look at it from a positive light, Sam Farr, at the Santa Cruz City Council chambers. Now, there are going to be people who will say, well, hey, you know, Sam has signed on to this letter by Lynn Walsey, which is a good letter, which talks about setting a timetable for withdrawal from Iraq. And I've actually commended him. I've called Farr's office and commended him for doing this, admittedly a year and a half late in the game. And, you know, but I've also noted on this station here that he hasn't put anything on his website about this issue. And he's got a lot of pro-military stuff on his website. Let's see if we can reach his letter. Let's see here. There's a little something. Sam Farr's newsletter apparently talks about, no, talks about Social Security and homelessness as an ongoing problem countywide. Board is to help address the homeless problem in Santa Cruz. Farr announced the delivery of $1.18 million in federal funds to various agencies. And, of course, that's very nice. I'm glad to hear that, although what percentage of those funds will actually reach homeless people is always kind of problematic, particularly when homeless people have no real representation in the distribution of those funds. And, of course, this happens in a jurisdiction where it's criminal to be homeless in terms of certain basic essential things like sleeping at night, where it's illegal, covering up with a blanket. Well, here's the Woolsey calls for hearing support troops by bringing them home February 9th, immediate release. U.S. Rep. Lynn Woolsey, Democrat of Petaluma, called for the House International Relations Committee to have hearings on her resolution, HCON Res 35, for President Bush to begin the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. Representative Woolsey led 27 members of Congress in supporting the resolution. One of those was Farr, to his credit. Earlier this month, Woolsey led 15 members of Congress in sending a letter to President Bush requesting the return of U.S. troops from Iraq, and one of those was Farr, to his credit. Representative Woolsey's HCON Res 35 calls for the President to, one, develop and implement a plan to begin immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. So that's not really withdraw the troops from Iraq. It's develop and implement a plan to begin the immediate withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq. So it's kind of futzing around a bit, but it's heading in the right direction. Develop and implement a plan for the reconstruction of Iraq's civil and economic infrastructure. Convene an emergency meeting of Iraq's leadership, Iraq's neighbors, the United Nations, and the Arab League to create an international peacekeeping force in Iraq and to replace U.S. military forces with Iraqi police and National Guard forces to ensure Iraq's security and take all necessary steps to provide the Iraqi people the opportunity to completely control their internal affairs. Which may mean funding more, what, death squads against... it's kind of hard to tell. I mean, if you've moved in and wreaked havoc in a country, then you're supposed to go in there and fix it all up. I don't think the people who've wreaked the havoc can fix it all up. Anyway, the following are Representative Woolsey's words as written for today's press conference, that's several weeks ago, on Capitol Hill. Everyone who loves freedom was moved by the courage of millions of Iraqis braving death to cast a ballot on January 30th. The Iraqi elections, however, do not justify this war, neither the lies used to sell it nor the incompetence with which it has been managed. The elections won't bring back the dead or heal the wounded. They won't reimburse the American taxpayers billions of dollars. And the elections won't stop the vicious insurgency that is terrorizing Iraqi communities. I won't comment on that. But the elections do demonstrate that Iraqis are prepared to manage their own affairs. That is why I believe now is the time to develop and implement a plan to bring our soldiers home and to end the U.S. military presence in Iraq as soon as possible. I've written a letter to the President urging him to do so. Together with 27 co-sponsors, I've introduced a resolution in the House of Representatives calling for a plan to end this military misadventure. And today, I'm calling on the House International Relations Committee to start hearings on the matter. The Bush administration spared no superlative in talking about the significance of the Iraqi elections. Such a momentous watershed event would seem to demand a shift in our thinking about Iraq. But not for President Bush. He is now emboldened. He sees this as a mandate to keep our soldiers there as long as he wants. He and his surrogates are even engaging in a little provocative saber rattling in the direction of Iran. But the Iraq elections didn't vindicate the doctrine of preemptive war. They demonstrated that Iraqis can and should take control of their own destinies. Leaving will not defeat the insurgency, but staying will only intensify it. What is fueling the insurgency and what gave rise to it in the first place is our continued military presence in Iraq. Our troops, whom the administration assured us would be embraced as liberators, are a focal point of anti-American extremism. Let me be clear. I am not advocating a cut-and-run strategy. It would be irresponsible for the United States to abandon the Iraqi people. Uh-huh. We must play a role in facilitating their transition to stable democracy. We ought to work with Iraq, the Arab League, and the United Nations to create an international peacekeeping force that would keep Iraq secure. And those oil wells, too. My addition. Some of the money we are spending on this military campaign could be diverted to infrastructure projects that will improve Iraqi lives, road construction, new schools, water processing plants, and more. Up to this point, Iraqi economic development has been scandalously mismanaged by the Bush administration, as billions of dollars appropriated by Congress have not actually been put to work on the ground. All future investments must be made with the needs of Iraqis, not U.S. government contractors and other war profiteers, being paramount. I believe a focus on development and humanitarian aid in Iraq would be a model for a radically new approach to national security. We need what I call SMART security, which stands for Sensible Multilateral American Response to Terrorism. Instead of resorting to the military option and spending needlessly on weapon systems, the SMART security plan I proposed last year for building multinational, multilateral partnerships that enable us to foil terrorists and stop weapons of mass destruction proliferation, and addresses the conditions that lead to terrorism in the first place: poverty, hopelessness, despair. Instead of troops, we should send scientists, educators, urban planners, and constitutional experts to the troubled regions of the world. It is time for the U.S. to be Iraq's ally and partner, not its occupier. It's time to give Iraq back to its own people, and it's time to truly support our troops by bringing them home. Supporting Woolsey's resolution are U.S. Representatives Xavier Becerra, John Conyers, Danny Davis, Lane Evans, Sam Farr, Raul Grijalva, Maurice Hinchy, Michael Honda, Carolyn Kilpatrick, Dennis Kucinich, Sheila Jackson Lee, Stephanie Tubbs Jones, Barbara Lee, John Lewis, Jim McDermott, Cynthia McKinney, Gwen Moore, Grace Napolitano, Major Owens, Ed Pastor, Donald Payne, Charles Rangel, Jan Chakowski, Jose Ferrano, Pete Stark, Maxine Waters, and Diane Watson. And that's a story from the Common Dreams Progressive Newsletter. Woolsey calls for hearings, support the troops by bringing them home. If you have any thoughts on any of this, you can always call in, 427-3772. Sure. For those interested in the anti-war movement, here's a story off of Counterpunch, the anti-war movement after Kerry, Learning All the Wrong Lessons, by Sharon Smith. It is unfortunately a little-known fact that thousands of high school and college students across the country organized walkouts against the war on January 20th, marching as organized contingents to counter inaugural demonstrations in Boulder, Colorado, Los Angeles, Chicago, San Francisco, Austin, Texas, and other cities. At Seattle Community College, students took a few minutes on their way out of the building to confront military recruiters, forcing them to flee under the protection of campus security officers. One of the recruiters, claiming student protesters flung newspapers and water bottles in his direction, told the Seattle Post-Intelligencer they were all going by making offhand comments and saying no war. We just waved at them. 5 minutes later, there was a mob of 500 people surrounding the table. Be nice if UCSC allowed this kind of protest, that is to say, didn't try to move people away from buildings during protests, set up protest areas. Interesting discussion of that is also happening on Indie Media for those who want to check it out at www.santacruz.indiemedia.org. There is a student rebellion in the making, coalescing around opposition to the war and its military recruiters, with students by the hundreds defying threats of disciplinary action. Despite their potential to transform the political landscape, however, the significance of these militant student actions has so far escaped the leaders of the nation's established anti-war organizations. Indeed, after fostering the illusion that supporting pro-war neoliberal John Kerry represented the only realistic strategy for those who oppose the war, these anti-war leaders now seem to have learned all the wrong lessons from Kerry's defeat in November. rather than seizing the opportunity in the months before the election to strengthen the anti-war movement as a clear alternative for the millions opposed to Bush. Virtually the entire movement came to a standstill to support the Democratic Party's chosen candidate, leaving those against the war with no organized expression to the left of Kerry's "hunt down and kill all the terrorists" mantra. Even as the torture scandal at Abu Ghraib surfaced and the U.S. invaded Fallujah and Najaf, finally flattening Fallujah in November, the U.S. anti-war movement maintained its silence. Since the election, the anti-war movement is showing signs of revival, but the same leadership responsible for the movement's hiatus during the presidential campaign is once again seizing the reins of control over the movement. These anti-war leaders have yet to acknowledge their own role in the Kerry debacle, much less the anti-war movement's decline. Most accept the view that Bush's re-election provides indisputable evidence that, quote, Christian values and conservative politics dominate among the U.S. population, requiring those on the left to adapt yet further rightward in the aftermath of Kerry's defeat. United for Peace and Justice co-chair Bob Wing lamented recently, "Our original hope was that the movement would grow, but things have not worked out that way, and it is dangerous and unstable for a coalition to have a broader and deeper political unity than most of its member groups." Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the women's peace group Code Pink, told the San Francisco Chronicle on January 23rd, "It was easier to mobilize people before the war. Now many people have fallen into thinking we can't just cut and run." This pessimistic conclusion is, however, somewhat premature and disingenuous, since the anti-war movement itself has thus far failed to attempt to build an opposition that is clear on this question. On this basis, however, some anti-war leaders now propose continuing a self-defeating strategy for the foreseeable future. As the headline of a January 16th San Francisco Chronicle story put it, "Bush protesters rethink tactics. Critics hope to move beyond self-satisfaction of anti-war protests, gain wider voting base." The article stressed anti-war leaders' desire to retreat from organizing mass demonstrations in order to begin preaching beyond the choir box. "We've got to start reaching out to people who don't agree with us," Leslie Kagan, United for Peace and Justice's national coordinator, told the Chronicle. The paper's report added, "In its recent short-term plan, the 850-organization umbrella behind many of the nation's larger protests over the past few years conceded the anti-war movement must reshape its work." In a follow-up interview, Kagan put forward some suggestions for reshaping the movement's strategy, including greater emphasis on winning allies in Congress. "For instance, when Bush goes to Congress later this year with a request for another $100 million for the war, we will do what we can to get a no vote." She adds, "It's a long shot, but we're going to try." This certainly is a long shot, considering that Democrats have squandered the opportunity to define themselves as an opposition party. The main Democratic Party proposals in Iraq, in fact, is the introduction of yet more U.S. troops. The speed and aggression with which U.S. imperialism has pursued its global aims since September 11th has been possible only because this is a bipartisan project in which Democrats as well as Republicans have enabled all of Bush's policies to pass, often enthusiastically. The Institute for Policy Studies' Phyllis Bennis drew out further implications of a congressional study in widely circulated notes to the UFPJ Steering Committee, that's the United for Peace and Justice Steering Committee, elaborating on the need to move beyond forging links with Democrats to right-wing Republicans voicing doubts about Bush's losing occupation strategy. "We need to figure out how to strengthen this popular anti-war opposition, perhaps linking it with growing elite and particularly right-wing opposition," she argued. While these new anti-war leaders are looking upward to Congress and to their right, to conservatives for allies, they are missing the radicalization gathering momentum below, among those rejecting their intended role as cannon fodder for the war, who are already organizing protests outside the auspices of the established movement. In reality, U.S. society today is characterized by sharp polarization on virtually every social and class question, including the war, dividing workers, students, and military families. This polarization was very much in evidence during the 2004 election and has only grown in its aftermath. The right wing only appears so dominant because of the absence of a genuine left opposition. Yet so many who led the U.S. left on its disastrous course have taken no responsibility for the results, a barely discernible political left in the face of a confident, coherent, and growing right. To influence Congress, our most effective tool is not compromise, but a confident, coherent, and growing opposition to the Iraq occupation. We should exploit every division at the top, even between Republicans, but this can only be done effectively by wielding a clear ideological counterweight backed by mass forces. students organizing walkouts and sit-ins against the war are far in advance of the established anti-war movement in building this kind of opposition. It is worth noting that the vast majority of student walkouts have taken place not on elite campuses, but at working-class commuter colleges and high schools, the main targets for military recruiters seeking to prey upon working-class students facing the increasingly unattainable goal of a college education. The No Child Left Behind Act requires high schools to turn over student contact lists to military recruiters. But some schools are affected more than others. For example, the exclusive and private Chicago Latin School, while receiving $40,000 in federal money last year, has not been asked by recruiters to turn over its student list for the last 6 years. It's a little embarrassing, spokeswoman Evelyn Guillardette admitted to the Chicago Tribune. Students at working-class high schools, in contrast, receive regular calls from recruiters. We do not want the military in our schools asking our friends and family to fight for a war that is wrong, SCCC student Nicole Thomas argued, defending the student walkout. We want recruiters out of our schools. These students, growing vets and active-duty military resistors, are part of a growing rejection of the war among those expected to fight it, pointing the way forward for the anti-war movement as a whole. An effective strategy must mobilize real forces around clear goals, and leadership is not earned by is earned not by title or even words, but by action and results. And that's from Sharon Smith, writing for the Socialist Worker newspaper, and that's on the Counterpunch website. And, of course, locally, we have a city council which, while it opposed the original Iraqi invasion, has refused to call for the withdrawal of Iraqi troops, much less the immediate withdrawal of Iraqi troops. Even such great peace activists as Emily Riley, who wandered by the SAFE event yesterday when I was ranting away myself, hasn't introduced any such resolution since she let one go because she was waiting for then-Mayor Kennedy to come back with a better one way back in April of 2003. We're nearly 2 years later, and we have no anti-war resolution coming out of our city council. This is a disgrace in a city with a palpably large anti-war majority, in my view. And, of course, this kind of right-wing, there's a right-wing shadow over all this, because you see things like the First Night situation, where the First Night drove the anti-war people essentially out of the parade 2 years ago. Well, they put them in the back of the parade, and they said, you can't flyer, and you can't leaflet, and you can't hold up big signs, and you have to be a part of the Wizard of Oz deal. And then they agreed to all these ridiculous conditions. I've talked about this before, and they were still drowned out and marginalized. And this year, of course, the First Night organizers refused to allow even the military families to be in the parade. But they're sponsoring a pro-right-wing parade, are willing to work with them for May. And there's some controversy about how this is to be dealt with. There's been some discussion on the Internet about what do you do with this upcoming pro-military parade. I mean, it's really the real issue is, where are the anti-war protests? And admittedly, there's one coming up in March, which is, of course, the anniversary of the invasion of Iraq, the illegal war of aggression against Iraq, and the current occupation of Iraq. And there's some signs that people are returning. There's folks downtown on Pacific Avenue on Sundays between 12 and 2. And there's, I guess, the Huff vigil against two war folks. The SAFE folks are supporting them. Huff does have this vigil against two wars, one of them being the war in Iraq, one the other being the war against the poor in Santa Cruz. I had an interesting conversation with a woman last night at the Huff table in front of a New Leaf Market who was telling me that this was very confusing, that these were not equivalent issues at all, and I was making it muddy for people who wanted to be supportive. But it turns out she did support ending the sleeping ban. She did support ending the war on the poor in Santa Cruz, and she did support ending the war in Iraq. So it wasn't. But she felt this was not the best way to go. And I suggested that she, do some tabling and discuss what she was doing. She hurriedly disappeared into the night. So, hey, come on down and table and check it out. It happens every Wednesday and every Thursday. It's happening now. This show's probably squeaking out over a tiny radio on Pacific Avenue. If you have reports of misconduct by police officers, hosts, CSOs, if you've been discriminated against at businesses, based upon your economic status, your appearance. It's important that not happen. And it's important that people be supported who are finding themselves in this situation. These are hard times, and this can happen very, very easily, and has been happening, as we've seen in the case of Jerry Henry and others. So think about that, and give me a call if you have any thoughts on it. In the meantime, here is a little musical interlude.
More important than your touch.
That was Valerie Christie, one of the Safe singers, singing pretty good. And we have someone on the line. Let's see. Are you there, caller?
Yeah, I can barely hear you. You were fine before.
Huh. How about now?
Yeah, now I can hear you.
Okay. Well, what you got for us?
Okay, well, I'm still in the process of digesting all the information from the city council meeting and other information I was able to gather since then concerning the pager antennas on top of the Palomar Inn.
Okay, this is
basically what happened was the city council voted 7-0 to approve or to uphold the appeal of the permit process that the Palomar was attempting to get to go through. So basically what that means is that they're within 90 days they're going to have new antennas on top of the Palomar with permits, and they're going to 45 days after that, according to the conditions passed by the city council, they're going to have a testing regime happen where they have to write a new report and do some more actual physical measurements of the radiation coming from the Palomar using meters, which are probably not all that sensitive for the purposes of the people are really concerned about it.
John,
but at least verify that they conform to FCC standards.
John, let me ask you a question. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Their original request was turned down, right? By the commission that would have granted this permit.
As I understand it, what happened was they allowed the existing antennas to remain there for now while they build some more while they rebuild the whole entire antenna array. And then after the antenna array is rebuilt, then it will be legal.
Well, the reason,
my understanding.
Well, my point is that this is an appeal of a decision by another body, so it must have been they didn't like the decision of that body, right?
Yeah, that was previous. I'm not going to get all clear on the details about what happened previously.
I mean,
all I know is that they were denied the permit because they didn't even have an ordinance in place to regulate the placement of these antennas anyway. So they put it off, basically, is what happened.
Well, I know the question has been, you know, what's the radiation deal? I know Marilyn Garrett has been particularly concerned about this. But for me, the issue was kind of an interesting one because this was way back, almost a year and a half ago or 2 years ago when the original hearing was held. And then later than that, some of the rules were changed around this. And the city council said, well, let's wait until the rules are changed. It's finalized, and we'll consider that. But it would seem to me that wouldn't the appropriate thing to be to send this back to the original commission for a reconsideration if the rules have changed?
I suppose, but I'm not real clear about why the original commission didn't vote in their favor.
Was there a lot of public testimony against or in favor of this?
No, basically what happened was I did the staff report, which basically was I consider it to be a whitewash because they only read from one half of the report that basically said that the proposed antenna array would be on the levels of radiation on the roof would be 50% or less of the uncontrolled public exposure limit for the new antennas, but they didn't go over the old report, which said that the previously existing antennas, at least I believe this is my interpretation of the report, the previously existing antennas were actually radiating up to 200% or more of the FCC limit on the roof. So if a kid climbs up on the roof today, right now, he'd be exposed to probably 200% of the FCC limit. Although the guy who wrote the report claimed that he had actually climbed on top of some of the structures on the roof to measure that, but I don't believe that necessarily. And so basically the other things that happened was that part of the process got messed up because, or was attempted to be messed with by Ryan Coonerty, who wanted to limit the discussion to only those points which are relevant to showing whether the antennas would be aesthetically pleasing or conform to FCC standards, and have nothing, he wanted nothing to do with any testimony about health effects or biological effects of radiation or any of that kind of crap. He didn't want anything to do with that as part of the testimony for this decision. And his reasoning was that the city could either be sued and or if they voted against it, if they voted against the appeal, that they could lose their right to even regulate the aesthetic appearance or the location or the zoning of cell tower antennas, because the federal government might take away even that small ability of the city to regulate the situation if we voted against it because of health effects.
I know that was an issue that the city had no power to consider the health effects, only the aesthetic effects, but did the city attorney, John Barisoni, respond to Coonerty's concern?
I don't remember if he did. I don't think he did. But Mike Rodkin responded. Basically, his points were the following. That first, not all at once, but throughout the meeting, we found out his opinion about the situation. One was that, first of all, you have the freedom of speech, so you have the right to testify whatever the hell you want to testify about, as long as it's reasonably closely related to the issue. You know, you're talking about the cell tower or the pager antennas. You know, as long as you're not talking about the boardwalk instead, you know, it's fine. And then the other part of his point was, a couple of points was, one, he thought he had the outrageous idea that there was absolutely no radiation at the top floor of the Palomar inside the building, because he was assuming that the antenna was relatively tall compared to the building, and that the radiation at the base of the antenna was essentially zero. But that's inaccurate because the antenna is actually distributed over the entire roof of the Palomar. So under any one antenna, you're not going to have a zero field because it's getting radiated from the other antennas. And also, the antennas are relatively short compared to the width of the building. So, you know, this argument that, well, the radiation is going to be zero for the residents on top floor is bogus.
So, did you point this out, and was there an immediate acclamation of hurrah from the city council?
Well, he had the last word on that particular issue. It was after the public testimony had already transpired. He came back with his typical so-what-ism, I would call it, for Mike Rodkin. You know, he says, well, so what about this? You know, and there was no chance to respond to it except what I'm going to do on Indy Media later when I finally get all my data together and actually publish it, you know, maybe as late as Saturday this week. But
you could always mount a referendum.
Yeah, a referendum to overturn their decision. Yeah, that's a possibility. But I don't know if Marilyn Garrett has deep enough pockets to support a referendum with the paid signature gatherers.
John, you've also been a regular participant in the Peace Fridays. Are they still doing those, or have they moved them to Saturday and doing them on the overpass?
That I'm not clear. I think they're actually that Saturday overpass thing was actually moved to Friday at 5 p.m., believe it or not. It was kind of surprising. I thought they would keep it on Saturday and do it then, but now they're going to be competing with Peace Friday on the very same time, but in a different place.
Hmm. So the word now is that if you want to join anti-war protests, you can either go down to Water and Ocean, or you can go to the 41st Avenue overpass at, 5 o'clock on Friday?
I'm not sure where it is, whether it's Branca 40 or 41st Avenue. I thought it was at Branca 40 last time.
Huh. Maybe on Indy Media there's a new post. I thought it was still on Saturday, but it's a little confusing. I also wanted to know, I guess I haven't heard yet throughout the hour, but this new organization on campus, Anti-War Org, have you heard anything from them as to what they're up to? Last Friday they supposedly had a meeting, and I think they called it.
No, I haven't heard anything about them.
Huh, okay. Wow. Well, so you... You fought the council, and the council won, eh, John?
Yeah, the council won, for now. And I did actually get a chance to try out Marilyn Garrett's little high HF detector, call it high-frequency detector. It doesn't really detect, well, I guess in microwave range it does detect actually up to 3 gigahertz, but it goes down to 3 megahertz. And I tried it out, for instance, in front of KSEO, it reads zero because KSEO read is at 1 megahertz, so it's outside the range of the meter, so that's expected. But then I got some criticism at the city council meeting by this guy named Bodan Pilosinski. He claims that he was involved with this peripherally, this Palomar antenna issue peripherally a while ago. And he got this exact same meter that Marilyn Garrett got. And he had some discussions with the manufacturer and some other people. He was not able to get a significant reading in front
John,
of the Palomar,
is the significance
similar
of
to what I...
The significance of this is that if you get a high reading on these meters, it actually is a real health hazard?
Well, it's debatable as to what the threshold is for a health hazard. It's also what I'm trying to point out here is it's debatable as to what the meters are actually reading, because this meter that I borrowed from Maryland, it appears to be off by a factor of 300 to 600. If you believe my trifield meter,
well, I expect
which I'm
to get
is accurate.
I expect to read all about this on Indie Media. It's a little obscure for the radio right now. I don't know if it's something that.
But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is that I redid the measurements after I spoke at the city council, and they appear to be actually, if anything, a little bit stronger than what I quoted at the city council meeting. But then I also followed Ed Porter's suggestion to go ahead and measure what was happening at the parking garage next to the Palomar, which is kind of like the closest point that the public can get to the antennas that are normally exposed, not including the people on the sixth floor of the Palomar. And that did not read anywhere close to the FCC limit, unlike what he was suggesting at the city council meeting where it might read 25% of the FCC limit. It was not anywhere close to that because the trifield meter read zero still. And I still have to double check and make sure that the new meter is not just giving me completely bogus readings.
Well, John, when you get this straight,
that it's supposed to be reading non-zero on the trifield meter.
Okay, well this
so
is
the, we have the, to double check that still.
These are technical details. I think a lot
right.
of people can't really follow. But you know when you get it down, and I know you're a regular contributor to Indie Media. You know, put it up on the Indie Media website, and we'll be able to follow it more carefully.
Right. I was thinking about publishing the tables and everything on Pages in Color because then I can get the numbers in the tables and everything straight.
Why not?
And
sounds like
a good
idea.
Through a huge post on Indie Media.
Any other reports on other issues? I know you're part of the Human Rights Organization, which meets, I guess, every Saturday, 4 o'clock at the Scene Fronteras.
Yeah, Scene Fronteras, every Saturday at 4 p.m.
That's the sleeping band, the blanket band, all those other bands. You're
right.
Out to ban the bands. And,
yeah.
Right. Well, good luck.
Okay.
All righty, man.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. And that is not quite the end of the show, but just about. And I'm going to start rolling out the farewell music because I think we're going to shortly be seeing the arrival of Uncle Dennis from the Cream to the Dregs. He's going to slide in and get some nice music ready for all of you. You can check me out again on Sunday. I'll be coming back at 9:30 in the morning, unless I can find something better to do, which is always a possibility. But that's the long show. We should have some interesting reports from the street, and who knows, maybe some interesting guests, too. A couple that didn't show up on this show, which we weren't able to get, might be coming in on Sunday. And, again, you can follow a lot of this action on Indie Media. There's a lot of breaking stuff happening there. That really is our local news source, I think, for a lot of these issues. If you're into anti-war issues and so forth. In the meantime, you can get active. Even if it means a phone call, you can call the city council, 420-5020, tell them to do something about, let's say, you know, the failure to adopt a resolution against the war in Iraq in terms of withdrawing the troops, the failure to adopt real protections against Patriot Act depredations by federal agents. Just a quick comment about medical marijuana. I did talk to one of the planning people in the planning department, Mike Ferry, who advised me that while it is true that Attorney John Barrasoni does apparently feel that the Supreme Court has essentially overturned Proposition 215, our state medical marijuana law, that will not necessarily prevent a new club from opening up. And that may be happening within the next few months if they can get 600 feet away from schools and so forth in the Harvey West area. And I'll be giving you increasing reports on that. So stay tuned for Uncle Dennis's From the Cream to the Dregs. And come on back on Sunday. In the meantime, give me a call at the 423 Huff line if you've got any huffing to do at me.
Kitty got mad and cut Lucy up.
A wise old judge sat in the court. The case was long, his judgment short. Why change the way it's always been?
The John goes free, but she's brought in.
If they want to hear a story, then I give out for the story about my mother who is dead and my father who's in jail on a frame-up. And I need $10 for Grandma who is coughing and spitting up blood. But what do you say we cut the crap every day? In every way, there's somebody turning a trick. There's somebody licking somebody's ass. There's somebody pulling it off under the table, in the back room, in the front office, with the curtains closed. There's somebody getting his percent. Is that what you do? It's up to honey. Every day, in every way, there's somebody making a deal. There's somebody humping somebody else. There's somebody taking it in behind the counter, under the carpet, in the big office of the big shot boss. There's somebody eating off somebody else. Is that what you do?
And you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm your Uncle Dennis, and I've been caught a little short here. We are sort of in Robert's in the process of getting his butt out of the studio, but he hasn't quite left. Yeah. Anyway, let's see. I can always scramble, you know. Anyway, this is Free Radio Santa Cruz, and Of course, you're listening to 101.1 most places. And, of course, people are screwing around with the little knobs. But anyway, we can fix all that. Oh, well, it's always fun to come in here on a Thursday evening and every single knob is in some weird position. Oh, well. I don't know. It's just one of those things about doing non-professional radio. That it's always interesting, you know. Is this yours, Robert?
No.
It's not. It's something. Anyway, for the next 3 hours, you'll be listening to music from the 60s and 70s, rock and roll, and all kinds of stuff. We'll start out with this one.
Had a soul, had a about a thing she saw.
After money and dreams that can't come true, I'm glad that we are different. We've better things to do. May others plan their future. I'm busy loving you.